for or against?
Good afternoon. I'd like to bring the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability to order. And I'd like to start out by wishing my committee members a happy new year and welcome back to the Capitol. We have most of our committee here. We're missing a couple of vice chairs that I think are running around the building somewhere taking care of important business. And so today we have a pretty full plate. It's my intent to really go through and introduce all of the concepts and House bills that are listed and pretty much in the order that they appear, pending anything could upset that, I suppose, but I'm not expecting that. And I'm judging from the amount of bills, I'm going to allot approximately 15 minutes per each bill. We don't necessarily have to spend that entire 15 minutes, but in order to get through all the bills, that's what I'm going to do. And so if you know, you've signed up to speak and somebody's already made your point, you may not want to make that point again. And albeit of these bills that move forward, there will be opportunities in the future to testify on these bills as well. So, and with that, I apologize up front for some of these concepts have just come out recently to get them in writing, to get them out to everybody, and some of them are still, you know, in rough versions that will require amendments if there's time to get that done in the time frame that we have in front of us. Also, if you wish, I am going to instruct my committee administrator to also take written testimony for a week from today on all of these concepts, so that if you don't get an opportunity to share all your thoughts and you want them all shared now, which is entirely pertinent as we're trying to refine these concepts, please submit them in writing to my committee administrator, or if you wish to send them to me directly, that's fine as well. It's my intent to try to have conversations with folks on all these concepts as we approach February and see where there may be some issues and problems, concerns, or whether everybody just loves every piece of it. That's the part of our process that I enjoy the most. So, with that, I'm going to.
Did you want me to say a few words about how the introduction process is going to work?
I will in a minute. I don't know if there's any particular need to introduce our committee members. We'll start down here to my right because I feel like I need to be reminded of where all the people on this dais come from.
I'm on the far right. I'm Representative Matt Wingard from Wilsonville.
Jefferson Smith from East Multnomah County, East Portland.
Carolyn Tomei, Southeast Portland and Milwaukee.
And I'm Representative Holby from Eugene, Crow, Applegate, Lorain, and Notai.
And I'm Representative Krieger from the South Coast, Coos, Curry, and part of Douglas counties.
Representative Gene Wisnett, Sun River, representing rural Deschutes County.
And Greg Matthews, representing House District 50, the great city of Gresham.
And my committee administrator, Patrick Brennan, of course, I don't know where he's from exactly.
Camby.
That's correct.
The Fighting Cougars.
So I appreciate everybody being here today, and we're going to go ahead and get started with opening a public hearing on House Bill 3610. And as I'm doing that, make sure that folks sign up on the sign-up sheets, and it will enable me to figure out how much time we have. And it is not Representative Girard, it is Representative Dennis Richardson in front of us on this particular bill. Relatively short bill with a change to, I believe, a piece of legislation that was passed last session. So welcome to the Consumer Protection and Government Accountability Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You'd introduce yourself for the record.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Richardson. I represent District 4, which is Southern Oregon from Western Jackson County across to Eastern Josephine County. This is a bill that Representative Girard has allowed to go in over his name since there was only one bill per person, and some representatives had no bills, and I had another bill that already had my name on it. Basically, there's a couple of realtors that had a concern over a small problem in Senate Bill 628 that we passed last session. That was a bill that basically said that a debtor has the opportunity to talk to a lender before there's a modification of a loan. And then the lender needs to provide an affidavit before there's a foreclosure sale saying that that provision was dealt with and was honored. The old wording said that the affidavit indicating that that had taken place would be filed on or before the date of the trustee conducts the sale. So you could actually have a filing taking place or being recorded on the same day that the sale is taking place, and that was too close to the sale, and you really don't know if that's happened or not. I imagine if I was involved in title issues or doing any kind of title search, I'd like to know that took place before the sale. And so all this does, the only thing this bill does, is change from on or before. It will now say not later than 5 days before. And so it just means that the actual affidavit needs to be recorded in the records 5 days before the foreclosure sale, not on the date of the sale. I mean, it just means that it has to be in advance. As an attorney, and years ago, I used to do some foreclosure work and that kind of thing a long time ago, and you don't wait to do anything to the date of the sale. And so this is not a major problem, but there were two constituents that thought it should be fixed, and so it's one of those things that made sense, and so that's the purpose of this bill.
Does anybody have a question of this particular legislator and this concept? I do have one. Can you explain just briefly what kind of problem would arise from the existing language of having that happen on or before the date as opposed to 5 days before? I mean, what problem does that present in the closing?
Only that you have certain requirements, hoops that have to be jumped through before you can have your foreclosure sale. And this one provision says that one of them does not have to be met until as late as the date of the sale.
Mm-hmm.
And it could even be after the sale. I mean, it says on or before the date of the sale. And so to assure that all of the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, that all the paperwork is in order, this merely says that this one requirement should be dealt with at least 5 days before the sale. Since foreclosures take months, it's not a burden on anyone.
Mm-hmm. I guess my question is, why 5 days instead of maybe three?
Oh.
It was a good
just number.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Mm-hmm. Well, you have about another 10 minutes.
I would defer my time to Representative Thatcher.
Well, seeing no one left to testify, thank you for coming forward and bringing us this. And we'll take a look at it.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3610, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3614. And Representative Thatcher is before us, sponsor of the bill, and welcome to the committee. Happy New Year.
Happy
and,
New Year.
Go ahead and identify yourself for the record and provide us your testimony.
Hey, thank you, Chair Holvey, the rest of the committee. I'm wish a happy new year to you, too. My name's Kim Thatcher. I represent Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And today I bring you, I think, is a very simple bill. It is non-controversial, and it's very timely considering the budget considerations we're going to be facing. It's a bill to establish core functions of state government. It basically sets up an 11-person, 11-member legislative task force to make recommendations on four things. One is what should it be doing? What are the core functions of government? Measurable outcomes for each core function, setting priorities for each state agency, and mission statements for each agency to carry out the priorities that sets forth some measurable outcomes. And it's not a new idea. Of course, our country was founded on a list of 20 specific federal powers, including defense from foreign invasion and certain public works and all that. But this is a concept that's now actually being used by Governor Kulongoski and his new reset cabinet, looking at options for restructuring state government. And there are some other states that have used this quite successfully. They decide first what are the core functions of government, and then they divvy up their budget accordingly. For example, Washington State former Governor Gary Locke used a similar system. He called them the priorities of government, and this was to avoid across-the-board cuts, and he was able to close a nearly $3 billion hole in the state budget and protect critical services. So something I think is very timely. New Mexico also was able to use this successfully. Massachusetts, other states. There are suggestions in the bill as to may or may not stay in there, as to seven suggested areas of core functions, but it's not set in stone. It's just to set the tone for a discussion. This will be a bipartisan committee, and to make recommendations to the next legislative session. And that's pretty much it. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Thatcher, I feel compelled that since my committee is so quiet that I at least ask a question, at least on every LC that comes up. So I'm sort of curious how this really differs from our budgeting process that the Ways and Means already goes through, because they basically identify what parts of government to fund every biennium, and so this would be a task force then to make recommendations on what they should fund, or I'm just kind of curious of that. And I think we had a similar bill last session similar to this, and I think it passed. It was I'm not recalling what number it was. I'll have to check on that, but can you provide any background on that?
Defining the core principles or core functions of government is a first step towards delivering. I mean, it's one thing to say you're going to deliver better, more efficient services, but that's hardly significant unless government should be doing it to begin with. It needs to know what it's delivering, why it's delivering it. And so this just kind of defines, it's kind of like a mission statement for the state, more or less, instead of doing kind of an ad hoc type of budgeting that we do now. Just to put it in simple terms.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this. And thanks for the quick conversation earlier today with your staff. Heard there is a similar bill, or was a similar bill that was passed, either maybe before I was in here, that did a similar thing. Can you help? Yeah. That's not a very good question, but do you know of? Here's a better one. Do you know of overlapping or similar things, similar bills, or other efforts that are happening that we should be aware of to either combine with this or differentiate from this?
Here's the 5 days.
Sounds like maybe you do, Representative.
I really don't. You're not aware.
I'm not.
Great. Okay. I'm not. I'm only vaguely. I am tutored by rumor. Mr. Chair, another question.
Follow up.
And are you open? I understand that the task force might come up with a different list, and we would offer them suggestions. Are you also how comfortable are we with this as a list of suggestions? Are you open to amendments on this list from the committee or others? And my assumption would be yes, but...
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, absolutely. That list was just a a starting point for the discussion, not absolutely set in stone. In fact, it says it may or may not include any of these suggestions. So it's just a starting point for discussion for the task force. They can look at what other states have done and choose to adopt those things and or not look at any of those things and just reinvent the wheel.
Great. One last question. Thanks, Mr. Chair. And to what degree have we already or should we overlay these set of core functions with work that was also done some years ago on like the Oregon Progress Board benchmarks, which tracked many things, probably more than we'd want to list in a bill, but to what extent have we sort of laid one on top of the other to see how they relate? Have we done, would that be a helpful thing? Have we done that yet? I certainly have not.
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, I think that would be very helpful to use what we've got but move forward and improve it. What we need to, we just need to decide what is most important to Oregonians and preserve those critical services like they were able to do up in Washington when they implemented their core functions governing up there back when was Governor Locke was in office.
Thanks very much, and as always, thank you for your work to try to make us be as efficient and effective as possible.
Thank you. And Representative Thatcher, I'm alluding to this previous bill as well, but I also know the governor's office has also done some work in this arena. They had an advisory committee on government accountability and performance, and where they did an exercise of identifying core functions. Is this bill taking that concept and codifying the results of it or codifying the process?
You know,
advisory committee.
Mr. Chair, this is kind of happening simultaneously, and I think it's great that the executive branch is taking those steps, but I think the legislative branch ought to also.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative Thatcher. You have approximately 7 more minutes if you'd like.
I yield. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a good day. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3614 and that open a public hearing on House Bill 3615. Thank you. Representative Call, you are up. I just opened a public hearing on House Bill 3615 and haven't really gone over it much. I don't know. We don't have staff major summaries at this point on these bills, so we'll rely on you to give us a little primer on what this bill does.
Well, this bill is a... pardon me. I'm going to make sure my phone shut off because of the... thing that happens.
Good idea.
I don't know if there's a term for it.
If you would identify yourself for the record, too.
Called pulling a call.
I'm Representative Nick Call. I represent East Multnomah County, House District 49. So this bill is relatively straightforward. If you look at its 9-page entirety, you'll see that 7 words are changed and there's an emergency clause. And so I'm going to focus today on what those 7 words do. By way of explaining just a little bit about the Unlawful Trade Practices Act in the state of Oregon. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act makes it unlawful for businesses to do a whole bunch of things, but mainly makes it unlawful for them to rip off consumers. And if they actually harm a consumer when they rip them off, they can get hailed into a court of law and be held liable under a negligence standard in a courtroom. And so if you look at this bill in these 7 or 8 or 6 words, however it finally came down, what we've done here is taken out the exclusion that has existed in the Unlawful Trade Practices Act for decades now. And this exclusion is really pretty simple. It means that if you're a bank or an insurance company, you get a free pass when you rip off a consumer. I know that may sound strange, but that's pretty much what the bill does. It makes it so that they don't get to do that anymore. Now, there's going to be a lot of talk around this bill. I'm certain of it. It's not the first time somebody's tried this. Hopefully it will be the last. But one thing I'd like to do is talk about what this bill doesn't do, because I don't want to get stymied in the details of what the unlawful trade practices do or don't do. Because this bill isn't about the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. This bill is about whether or not one industry or two industries should be excluded. That every other business in the state of Oregon should have to follow the law. Every other industry in the state of Oregon, when they rip off a consumer, can be held to account by that consumer and be held into a court of law by the Attorney General of the state of Oregon if the conduct is outrageous enough. Every other business in the state of Oregon, except for the banking and insurance industries. Now, there have been a lot of reasons in the past that have been brought up for why the banking and insurance industry should be excluded. Chief among them, the number one at the top of the list, we are heavily regulated, and we work to regulate ourselves, and those regulations that are put in place, well, they're solving the problem. Well, I think we can look at a deep and abiding recession that's a direct function of banking and insurance industry practices to show us very clearly that regulation isn't working, that these industries have not been good players, that they have defrauded consumers, and in the state of Oregon, they get a pass. Other states where banking insurance is a larger part of their economy have more progressive laws that allow banks and insurance companies to be held liable. Chief among them, New York State. The Attorney General of New York is actively pursuing civil sanctions against the banking industry. Now, this brings me to my second point, which is people will say that this is going to harm the banking insurance industries. The fact of the matter is the banking insurance industries have harmed themselves. And if the state of New York can pursue actions against the banking industry, where the banking industry, the center of banking in America, is located, and not think that it's going to harm their economy, I'm quite certain that we can make sure that in passing this law, that in making certain that banks and insurance companies are held to the same standard as other businesses, that it's not going to harm our economy detrimentally. In fact, it's going to help them. The third thing I want to say is that people are going to say, one of the arguments that will come forward is that this is a full employment act for lawyers, right? This is just going to bring a bunch of frivolous lawsuits into a court of law. If anybody believes that, I would like you to go down to your local courthouse and see how many suits are filed on a daily basis by banks and insurance companies against consumers. Hundreds, if not thousands, of cases are pending in Multnomah County right now by banks and insurance companies against consumers. And yet, in the state of Oregon, the opposite is not true because of this law. All I'm seeking here to do is level the playing field and say that there will be no more special treatment for banks and insurance companies. And just to make this clear to you, just so you can understand what's at stake here, if you go to a car lot and you buy a car and the guy who sells the car misrepresents the car to you, sells you a lemon, knew or should have known that the car was a lemon, you can take that car back to the lot. You can sue that person and redress your injury. You can be made whole. If a bank lies to you about the loan on that car, if an insurance company lies to you about the insurance coverage on that car, in Oregon, you're pretty much barred from recovery. That's what's at stake here. I can tell you that maybe in other times there could be a more nuanced policy debate, but right now there isn't. Regulation isn't working. Consumers are being harmed, and I think it's time that we end the special treatment for banks and insurance companies. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Representative Cole. Questions from the committee on this particular bill? So that leaves it up for me to ask you a question.
I wasn't going to get away that easily, huh?
No, you missed an earlier statement. Trying to ask at least one question, whether it's a good one or not. So, Representative Call, I noticed in the bill, as you said, there's just a couple of small changes in this particular statute, but it does have pretty broad implications, as you know. And I guess my question is, currently, of course, we have an insurance division and we have DCBS to some degree, overseeing financial institutions, and along with the federal government overseeing those same institutions or some of the other ones that we don't. And so how, I guess my question is, why is the consumer not protected in the current system that we already have, and why would we need to bring the insurance industry and the banking industry under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act when they are already regulated in other chapters in our...
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to answer the kind of be a little bit semantic in my answer to that question, because, I mean, when you ask why, I can't tell you why the regulations don't work, but they're not working. I mean, they're just not working. There's no way that you can look at our economy, that you can look at, you know, Wall Street being bailed out, taking millions of dollars, billions of dollars in money, American taxpayer money, paying themselves outrageous bonuses while people in Oregon are dramatically being foreclosed upon. I mean, I don't know why the regulations aren't working, but they're not. And what we saw last session with Senate Bill 628 was the fact that for some reason, we don't have the juice to regulate these guys effectively. We show up, we negotiate in good faith, we work with the stakeholders to try to get a bill crafted. We passed a bill that, honestly, the banking industry wrote, and then they opposed it, and now they're not complying with it. For me, this is a bill about exasperation. It's a bill about the very, very, very powerful special interests being able to come in, write laws, write their own regulations, and when time comes for them to actually comply with those regulations, they don't. The problem isn't DCBS or the AG's office. The problem is that we don't have any teeth in our laws that make it so people should comply. And this adds a little teeth. And honestly, I don't think it's so outrageous to say that if you're a bank or insurance company, you should have to follow the same law that every other business in the state of Oregon has to follow. This isn't about the substance of the law for me. This is about just saying, if you're a bank or insurance company, you just pretty much have to play by the same rules as every other business.
All right, thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, does this change any regulations that the bank has to follow, or is this, what does this do? It doesn't change anything, I don't believe, that the bank has to follow. So what's the point?
The point of this bill is that if you misrepresent a product to a consumer, you're going to be held liable. And I mean, if you'd like, I can get a bit into the semantics of distinction between proving common law fraud and what the UTPA requires. At common law, when in a fraud case, the two most important elements of a fraud claim are a knowing falsehood, right? Somebody lies to you and they know that you do it. And proving that somebody knowingly lied to you is very difficult. It's even more difficult when you have a major complicated document in front of you where the bank or the insurance company gets to go, no, see, it's here. Page 198, section 1, subparagraph A, article 2, in 10-point font, says right there, this isn't covered, or you have an arm, right? And I never told you that you had a fixed-rate mortgage, and so you're going to lose your house. You're going to have to pay more, right? And at common law, you're kind of stuck. But if you're talking about the UTPA, and you're talking about a negligence standard, bank comes in, sells you a house, you sign a loan, they know or should have known that no way you could have paid for that, maybe they should be a little bit responsible. And I'm not talking about taking away people's responsibility to know what they're getting into, right? I'm not talking about that at all. I'm talking about the specific, maybe minority of cases where you have an actual falsehood, where somebody's actually misrepresenting a product to a consumer, and under current law, you don't get to go into a courtroom. Changing these seven words makes that possible.
Thank you.
Mr. Representative Gilliam.
Mr. Chair, are we going to hear other folks on this bill today?
I hope not. Oh, you were just
talking
to me.
I was asking the chair. Right. We are.
Yes. Do you have a question of Representative Cole?
No. I'll wait and see what else we have.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Cole. You may have said this, forgive me, you may have said this in your prepared testimony. What do we know about what other states do, and how does that or does that not impact their competitive position in, you know, flow of capital, et cetera? Have we seen, you know, what examples can we draw?
Yeah, I mean, depending on the state, I mean, I guess what I would say is that there are more states, there are states that are more progressive than us, but aren't necessarily attacking it in this way. Which is to say that, you know, when you're talking about consumer protection statutes, it's most of the time effectuated piecemeal, one industry at a time, because you don't get to take on all the industries at once. And so things are littered throughout a statute. So there are states that have similar provisions in their UTPA, and I can get you that. There's a clearinghouse that has actually done this data. But even beyond that, there are states that have things like common law bad faith that the state of Oregon doesn't have. And there was a piece of legislation brought last session that failed that would have gone much further than this with regards to requiring allowing a bad faith claim against a first party insurer. If you look out there into the states and see what's going on, I would say that this does not make us an outlier at all. If we were to change our law in this way, this would put us in line with a lot of different states. And if I might say one thing in closing, Mr. Chair, just very briefly, for folks who this is something I forgot to say, is that there's going to be one last thing that's going to be said, is that people are going to say that maybe just the banking industry is responsible right now, maybe we should only go for the banks and not the insurance companies, or just the insurance companies not for the banks. The single largest recipient of TARP funds was AIG, and they're an insurance company. It is impossible to disaggregate the conduct of the banking and the insurance industry with regards to our current recession and our current financial crisis. And all I want to do is make it possible for Oregon consumers to redress their grievances against those parties that have harmed them. And right now, Oregon law precludes such an outcome.
Thank you, Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Appreciate you coming forward with the bill. And we'll hear from some from the other side. And I'd like to have Paul Cosgrove, Sean Miller, and John Powell come up. And certainly, gentlemen, I know that you probably have a strong position with a lot of statements to make about this. I know a lot of you have turned in written testimony, so I'm going to try to keep it down to a couple minutes apiece if I could. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove, representing both the Oregon Financial Services Association, one of the state-regulated financial institutions, and the American Insurance Association, an association of insurance companies also regulated by the state of Oregon. And I recognize there'll be other opportunities for us during the session to talk about this. I guess I'd just like to respond to a couple of items. The reason that the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, at its initiation, excluded insurance, and shortly thereafter by order of the courts in Oregon excluded financial institutions, is because we do not regulate those, I beg to differ with Representative Call, in a piecemeal basis. We actually have multiple chapters of Oregon statute, literally pages, almost an entire volume, that deal with the regulation of various kinds of financial institutions and insurance. And it was felt that, in fact, this was a statute that should be applied to those businesses primarily who are not regulated, or at least not regulated heavily by the state, because in those cases there needed to be a general law to deal with fraud and misrepresentation. Fraud by an insurer or by a financial institution is actionable by the state. It's actionable by the state right now, and aggressively so. Breach of contract, because of course we all have contracts, whether they be insurance contracts or loan contracts with our consumers, are actionable by the state in some cases, but also by individual consumers. So consumers are not cut out of the courthouse if they have been wronged by financial institutions. They either have the state that can enforce the multiple statutes and standards against those entities, or in a breach of contract situation can bring claims themselves in court. I guess at that point I would just stop and be happy to answer questions and be happy to be part of the conversation as we go into the February session. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association in opposition to House Bill 3615. And just to add to Paul's comments, the UTPA was intended to prevent, provide relief on factual misrepresentations about the characteristics of that product or service on the time of the sale. And on the expansion of this particular act onto insurance, we believe will result in lawsuits relating to the performance under the insurance contract themselves, which is already covered by breach of contract laws, which also allows for attorney fees and provisions. And so, you know, we look at this as this idea of, you know, what is wrong with the insurance division as well and their regulatory authority over the insurance industry. I would beg to differ that we somehow have a free pass or that consumers are precluded from a remedy, because they do have a remedy. There is a complaint process and a formal process, and the fact that we would cross the insurance division when they can take one of our company's license and actually put us out of business is a very big hammer. The idea that, creeping a misrepresentation of a product and service actually into the contract themselves, we believe will then just result in numerous lawsuits regarding the contract, breach of contract, which is already currently covered in the regulations that we have to adhere to. So, again, looking at whether this was an outlier or common with other states, we believe this would be more or less an outlier in respect, because I think it would increase the amount of litigation and then increase the cost to consumers for their insurance. And so with that, I'll just conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
Sorry, Charles. Chairman, thank members you. Of the committee, my name is John Power, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and Liberty Mutual. Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to answer your questions.
Caught me off guard. Mr. Powell, I assume that the three testifiers here are opposed to this legislation. Is that correct?
Chairman, that's correct.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question. That is, if these things are covered already under laws and consumers are protected, what would cause this new rash of lawsuits?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, in each of these industries, both insurance and financial institutions, and with financial institutions, it's developed differently with different kinds of financial institutions. We've set up a whole system where different kinds of harms are remedied in different kinds of ways. This overlays a new kind of remedy for what might be exactly the same kind of harm. It's duplicitous, and there's nothing in the Uniform Trade Practices Act, in fact it expressly says it's in addition to any other remedy at law, that would mean that you wouldn't have a second bite at the apple, a second lawsuit, or another claim for another set of damages for the same harm. So that's the duplication.
Follow up. So, again, if there's already this on the books somehow to take care of, if you already have this lawsuit or however the remedy is taken care of, what new lawsuits would there be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, in some cases, the remedies you have are a process where the state does an administrative procedure, which is not a lawsuit. And in fact, with these highly regulated industries, the most common remedy that consumers have is that. And that's an administrative procedure. It doesn't go to the courts, generally speaking. And it usually ends at the administrative agency, and there is no lawsuit. There's no burden on the courts whatsoever. It's fast, it's effective, it's pretty potent, and that's where it ends. This would add a lawsuit to that.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Representative Riley asked the question I was going to ask, but I'm still there. So when I have town halls and I hear from my constituents, they're not at all happy with what's happening both in the banking industry and in the real estate and mortgage loan industry. So when I tell them, don't worry about it, the state is going to take care of these. We'll have the agencies look over the concerns that you have and complaints you have and the injustices you feel that you've been rendered. So what they want is a way to take their particular case to court and make sure there was a remedy for their case, not just something that some state agency is going to be taking care of for them. So how can I respond to them? Why would I tell them this is not a good change in the law for them in particular?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, it's difficult to address that issue without specifics because, as Mr. Cosgrove pointed out, the consumer does have a cause of action in the case of a violation of their agreement. So is it, if we're talking about specific cases and somebody was wronged under the contract, they do have a cause of action. So if it is that they signed a loan that they can no longer pay for and those types of issues, then I think the regulator, that is more appropriate at a regulatory agency.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I may add, there are, in your lending example in particular, but it's not the only example, there already are very specialized consumer remedies where consumers can take lenders to court for violation of the Truth in Lending Act, which is a disclosure act about what the terms are, or the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, or any number of other things that are specially designed to fit what lenders do and where consumers could be harmed with what lenders do. And that's in addition to the breach of contract remedy Mr. Powell mentioned. So there are actually many, many places in many courts that consumers can take those cases. Almost all of them have attorney's fees provisions. Many of them have statutory damage provisions like the UTPA has both of those. And that's why this becomes an overlay, another cause of action or another lawsuit in another court for something that there's already a whole body of law and a whole set of remedies, not just state agency remedies, individual consumer-initiated remedies that exist. And that's true with both industries. This just brings another layer of it.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and I need to move on to the next
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Panel. If Representative Gilliam, do you want to ask?
They're leaving. It's okay.
You'll have another opportunity,
I'm
sure.
I appreciate that.
We have three more people. Maybe you can ask one of them.
All right.
Mike
Becker,
Deborah Heron, and Lana Butterfield. And I appreciate your brevity. If you don't mind not repeating previous testimony, it might help.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Regents is a health insurer, a licensed health insurer in Oregon, and I would like to focus my comments today on the regulation of health insurance because it is unique among the financial sector that's been talked about today. So for all of the reasons that have come up so far as to why this particular bill is not needed, there is yet an entirely different set, an additional set of reasons why it is not needed for the health insurance industry, and let me talk about those. There is comprehensive regulation of health insurance through a variety of things, touching on some of the main ones. Health insurers are required to file and have their contracts approved for individual and small groups. There is rate review of the annual rates for those contracts. There are financial filings. There are audits for finance, and there are audits and market review and market conduct examinations for how that health insurer is treating its customers in the marketplace, in the sale, in the management of claims, in the payment of claims, in the entire transaction. All of that is monitored and by the insurance department through targeted market conduct examinations, consumer complaints, provider complaints, and data that they run on insurers to look for anything that is an outlier as it relates to the insurance code and the insurance regulations. There are also extensive remedies. In addition to fines and corrective action against a carrier, the insurance department can take a carrier's license for violation, egregious violations of the insurance code. Most importantly, however, there is something called the Unfair Trade Practices Act within the insurance code, applicable specifically to health insurers, and there are specific, the unfair trade practices are applicable to all insurers, but applicable specifically to health insurers is also the Patient Protection Act. And that was put in place over two different legislative sessions, the most recent being 2001. And the Patient Protection Act was a negotiated self-determination of how consumers, unions, the plaintiff's bar, insurers, and other advocates coming together and self-determining what would be an appropriate set of remedies to protect patients of health insurance. And one of those things is external review, unique to health insurers. And there's a provision in the code for external review. External review is selected by the insurance department. These external reviewers are not picked by the insurance company. In addition, there is specifically a private cause of action when a carrier does not follow external review and has agreed not to be bound by external review. That private right of action exists. So that self-determination was put in the code as part of the Patient Protection Act. And because of that private right of action, because of the extensive protections and regulation, I would encourage the committee not to exempt health insurers from this request for additional regulation.
Thank you. Ms. Heron? Can you wait until we get done with all three of them? Can you remember it that long? Great.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, I'm Deborah Heron here on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition. And in line with the coalition's objective to lessen adverse impacts to businesses, we are opposed to this proposed legislation, as we feel that the insurance and banking industries are already thoroughly regulated, and any additional regulation at this time is unnecessary and would ultimately result in higher costs to the consumer.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Identify
yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lana Butterfield, and I'm here on behalf of the Professional Insurance Agents of Oregon, Idaho. You have in your packet statements from some of our members. I'm not sure that I have anything more to add than what Mr. Powell and Mr. Cosgrove and Mr. Miller said. They're from the property casualty side, as am I. So we just wanted to place our opposition to this bill on record. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the written testimony. It's often very helpful to remember the bill when you have something in writing to go back to instead of trying to remember what people said.
Mr. Chair, I would just say to you that I've been doing insurance lobbying since 1986, and I keep all of my files. And I have here a letter from a session I can't even identify on this topic. It's written by an attorney who specializes in this area of law. It's really good. So if you'd like to see it, I'd be happy to provide it.
Certainly, I would. Thank you. Representative Smith, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize, I'm forgetting your name, and I saw if I...
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, Mike Becker with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield
Becker,
of Oregon.
Thank you very much. Sorry about that. The health insurance specific UTPA, does it apply almost identically to the more broad bill here? And to the extent there are differences, what are those differences?
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, the Insurance Unfair Trade Practices Act applies broadly to all insurers, and that has, and I'm not prepared to do a line-by-line comparison to the general Unfair Trade Practices Act at issue in this legislative proposal. But in addition to, within the insurance code, the Unfair Trade Practices Act, there is just a specific code section dealing with health insurers, and that's the Patient Protection Act. So that is yet an additional layer of protection just for patients, consumers of health insurance.
And just so I'm understanding, I've still much to learn around this. The patient protection, is that a civil court protection? Is that a degree of regulatory oversight? Is, as Mr. Cosgrove mentioned, an administrative procedure? What does that provide for?
Chair Hovey, Representative Smith. It is a variety of all those things. There are administrative remedies under the code. There is external review of decisions for medical necessity and such decisions by insurance companies, and there is a private cause of action in certain situations where a carrier doesn't follow those external review decisions. But just listing the items within the Patient Protection Act, it includes the external review, there's continuity of care, there's referral to specialists, there's network adequacy, there's the right to sue. And those are the general parameters of what's found within that Patient Protection Act.
Thanks. Mr. Chair, one more?
Follow-up.
And so, I mean, I very much understand and appreciate the general resistance to saying, clearly part of the job that each of you have is to say, okay, we're going to create a private right of action against your clients. And if I were you, my answer would be, no, I don't want a private right of action against my clients. It's the last thing I'm paid to stop that. The in terms of the additional specific burden that it would impact, or the specific impact it would have on your clients, is it that we're concerned that there would be another line on the same lawsuit? Or, you know, just sort of, yet in, you know, in the laundry list of claims, there'd be another little line on that list of claims? Or are we concerned that there are certain types of suits that would happen that right now don't happen?
Chair Holvey, Representative Smith, I think it would be several of those things. We would see in every breach of contract lawsuit, you would also see claims for negligence and breach of the Unfair Trade Practices Act. You would see claims for punitive damages. Those things don't occur at the current time. Yes, we have breach of contract lawsuits, but those tort claims and those punitive damage claims aren't part of that, except in the narrow instance that I mentioned of external review and when that procedure kicks in under the insurance code that allows that particular private right of action.
Gotcha. Thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Tomei?
Well, that's okay. I think this representative was in line before me, sir.
Oh, okay. Well, he came in last, so I was going to have him ask last.
I'm glad you noted that.
Representative Gilliam?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just sort of reeling from a very entertaining speech by my colleague, Representative Call. And he painted some pretty broad strokes with his brush, and he had a lot of passion. But trying to get at this thing, I guess the thing I agree with him the most on is that I do hope this is the last time this is brought forward. For your industry, would you agree with his statement that it's not working, that there are grievances that are not being addressed? You basically agree with that the system, we have two regulatory avenues. Is it broken, in your opinion?
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, no. And I think if you look at the complaint records of, and I'm speaking for the health insurance industry, which are required to be filed with the Department of Insurance each year, the number of complaints that we get, it is amazing how small, how few that number of complaints that there are. Secondly, I would point to the requests for external review. Health insurers have extensive internal procedures for review of claim denials, going to our medical directors, reviewing those claims extensively internally before they ever get to the point where it has to go to external review. So again, if you look at the numbers of external review requests that the insurance department receives, again, those are few and far between. And there are expedited review requests that are allowed in exigent circumstances. So I think when you look at that, you look at the number of enforcement actions from the insurance department and how carefully regulated carriers are in forms, in rates, in market conduct action, I do not see in Oregon the type of abuses that we read about in the papers that perhaps are happening in other states.
Other questions? Representative Riley.
Very quickly. Ms. Herron, could you tell me again about your organization? I missed you know, who you represent and what kind of organization that is.
Absolutely, Chair Holvey, Representative Riley. The Oregon Liability Reform Coalition is a coalition of entities, businesses, and otherwise that have come together to be attentive to civil justice reform in the state of Oregon. So the types of things that we care a lot about are things exactly like this bill that's proposing to change the Uniform Trade Practices Act.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
And what other kinds of things is your organization involved in? I'm just trying to understand the organization.
Absolutely. It's a relatively new organization that was formed about 2006. All types of tort reform, as well as legislation that would impact businesses in an adverse way. Off the top of my head, I'm sorry, we also are very interested in civil justice reforms like jury service pools, making sure that people can serve in juries and have the ability to do so.
Okay. That's another thing. Thank you very much.
I'd be happy to meet with you one-on-one and
That'd
share
be great.
More.
I'd like that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions, I appreciate your testimony today. Thank you very much. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3615 and open a got quite a ways behind schedule with that particular bill.
I can help you catch up.
And I believe our next one will help us catch up. So I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 3629. And up I have Paul Romaine. I don't know if Representative Wingard wanted to speak to this at all.
I'm happy to let Mr. Romaine speak to the bill.
Fine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I represent the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. I'll spend the next 30 minutes going in through detail in every little nook and cranny of this bill. So let me begin. The bill is simple. Basically, we represent the pawnbrokers. We have a policy where we work with our regulators, the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We go to them with concepts. They come to us with concepts. We go to them with potential changes or problems with the legislation. And this bill has been worked out with the department. There are a couple of fairly minor changes just to clarify what the pawnbroker law does. The first one, which you find in section 1, paragraph 2, basically clarifies that a pawn loan is 60 days or longer if agreed to by the consumer. It doesn't have to be successive 60-day periods where you're renewing it constantly. You can actually have a longer period of time. Gives the consumer actually a little more stability, doesn't subject them to any more additional fees that kick in upon renewal. It also clarifies what is a renewal versus a new loan. If you basically are using that same item to do a loan on the same day, it's a renewal. It's not a new loan. The other thing it does in the bottom, paragraph 6, right at the bottom, it changes the delivery. The pledger has a grace period of 30 days from the delivery of the notice to mailing date of the notice. That's consistent with all other sort of date triggers in the law. You'll see that actually on the next page, paragraph 7, uses mailing date. It's impossible to know the delivery date. It's easy to know the mailing date. So it's just a simple change. The amendment, there's an emergency clause just so this gets in effect immediately, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'm sorry I didn't take up the 30 minutes.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, first of all, when you say department, what department did you mean?
Department of Consumer and Business Affairs or Services, DCBS.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Does this bill in any way, directly or indirectly, improve the situation of, how do I put this, stolen goods? Does it does it make that a more defined situation or improve the ability for us to have fewer possibilities of stolen goods in a pawn shop? Is this off? Am I totally off the subject, or is it part of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, only if you... No. I won't even... I'm not even going to try to engage you. No. as tempted as I am to get into a little banter on this, no. Actually, what you'll find is in pawn shops, you find very few stolen items. Pawn shops have to report literally serial numbers, descriptions, everything to the police. It's a highly regulated atmosphere, and it's actually a pretty neat place to go.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Romain, my one question would be on the last line in the first page, changing it from the delivery of the notice to the mailing date of the notice. And I'm just wondering what the significance of that is to the pledgor, and whether or not there's a specification on it is certified mail, I believe, in the
Mr. Chair, it depends on the amount of the loan, what kind of mail there is. But first of all, let me get to the, again, as I testified to just a little bit ago, mailing date, you know when the mailing date is. You don't know when the delivery date is. So mailing date provides a sense of certainty. It's also the standard that's used in all the different statutes, including the rest of the pawn statute. For some reason, delivery date happened to be there. And certified mail is used if the pledge loan is $1,500 or more. Below that, it's regular mail. And frankly, what you'll find with regular mail is more reliable than certified mail, because if you are in a situation where you're forfeiting something, you're more likely to actually open up something that comes regular mail than you are certified mail. What you find is people tend to shy away from certified and registered mail if their financial situation is not all that great.
Thank you. It clarifies it for me. Let's see, any other questions? Appreciate your testimony today and not quite getting us back on track, but I'm getting closer.
I can go along if you want.
With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 3624. That was 3629. So I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 3629 and opening a public hearing on House Bill 3624. And colleagues, you'll notice this is a bill that I am bringing forward as my personal bill after hearing from many folks in the industry about the issue of appraisal management companies, which have sort of become a lot more utilized in the lending industry since some federal regulation has come out specifically on the appraisal process and lending, which is, I think, perhaps complicated the industry a little bit more, and that's the Home Valuation Code of Conduct. And so it's an attempt to try to make sure that we still have independent appraisals that are accurate and can be trusted by the people that use them and rely on them for the valuation of their homes. There's currently no regulation, I believe, on appraisal management companies in the state of Oregon, and although we do regulate appraisers quite heavily, and they do have a pretty rigorous set of practices and standards they adhere to. So it with that slight introduction, I think I'll bring up Bob Keith, Roxanne Gillespie, please.
Good
Good afternoon and welcome to the Consumer Protection and Government Accountability Committee. If you would identify yourself for the record and provide us your testimony of why you think this bill should move forward. Thank you.
Chair Holby and members of the committee, thank you for hearing us. My name is Bob Keith, and I'll go first and lay a little background, and then Roxanne will explain maybe a little bit more about what this bill does and why it's needed. As I said, my name is Bob Keith. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board and past national president of the Association of Regulatory Officials for Appraisers. And before my employment with the board, I've been a career appraiser. The savings and loan crisis led to federal legislation which mandates regulation of real estate appraisers, including qualifications to become an appraiser, professional standards. And from then until now, the lending industry has grown and proliferated, and bankers and mortgage loan originators, loan officers, mortgage brokers, et cetera, historically have ordered appraisals directly from appraisers that they have developed and established relationships with. Unfortunately, over time, as the economy expanded during the last decade and real estate values escalated, there came a point in which those who were actually getting paid when loans were closing were the ones ordering the appraisals from appraisers who are supposed to be objective, unbiased, and objective. This created some conflicts. It created pressure on appraisers who compromised their independence to accommodate the needs of these loan officers and et cetera who are ordering appraisals. And I'd like to offer an example, and this kind of is what led to what Chair Holvey alluded to about the Home Valuation Code of Conduct. A number of years ago, there was an appraisal management company, which appraisal management company is simply a middleman or a broker between those who need appraisal services, lenders and financial institutions, and those who provide them, real estate appraisers. And lenders will often turn to appraisal management companies because it's more cost effective than to develop and maintain their own system of managing a network of appraisers across the country. So eAppraiseIt was one such appraisal management company, and they were one appraisal management company that was used by Washington Mutual's savings. And I'm going to use the word alleged here because this case was never adjudicated, but it was alleged that Washington Mutual senior management put some pressure on eAppraiseIt senior management to use appraisers from Washington Mutual's, quote, preferred appraiser list. And how you got on that list is that you had proven over time that you were an appraiser who was flexible and could go along and get along, and that you would bring the deals in value-wise what they needed to in order to make the loans work. Or in some instances, it had to do with appraisers that would ignore certain physical deficiencies of a subject property that they were appraising that would otherwise be called out and made a condition of the loan. And so Attorney General Andrew Cuomo of the state of New York filed a lawsuit against Washington Mutual, who, as it turns out, was a federally chartered financial institution, and the Attorney General had no jurisdiction. So he then issued subpoenas to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, huge secondary mortgage market participants, which got Freddie and Fannie's attention. And what came out as a result of that was an agreement, a private agreement between Andrew Cuomo, Freddie Mac, and Fannie Mae, that what was going to happen is that things were going to change, and that they were now going to have appraiser independence, and they're going to guarantee that through this code of conduct, the Home Valuation Code of Conduct. In this code of conduct, it requires lenders to only order appraisals from their own in-house staff, from those who are not a part of the loan production side, those who get, like I like to say, those who have a dog in the fight, the ones who get paid if the loan closes. Lenders can still order appraisals, but it has to be from a different department. Okay. However, what lenders have done, as I mentioned earlier, is they primarily migrated over to using appraisal management companies, these third-party brokers or intermediaries. Unfortunately, there are some unintended consequences because now, the by by far and large, the majority of residential mortgage loan appraisals are ordered through appraisal management companies. What that means is, since appraisers are no longer able to have mortgage broker clients, the only source of business for residential real estate appraisers now is appraisal management companies. So in my practice, I might have had 30 mortgage broker clients. That's been years ago. Now, if I was in practice, I may have 4 or 5 appraisal management companies. Each appraisal management company would be representing however many lender clients. And so, if I don't play ball, if I'm an appraiser and I don't play ball with an appraiser management company that tells me I need to have my appraisal turned around in 24 hours, okay, or I need to do this or I need to do that, and then some of the demands that these appraisal management companies are making on appraisers are ridiculous. And there'll be a time later, maybe we can go into that, not today. And so now if I'm an appraiser, if I tick off one of my 4 clients or one of my 5 clients, appraisal management company, there goes a third to 25-40% of my business. So now the issue of pressure on appraisers has been magnified even more than it was before the HB came in supposedly to save the day. Currently, there is no form of accountability. There's no form of regulation. There's no form of oversight of any kind of appraisal management companies. There's no process or no system that's in place for consumers to file complaints against appraisal management companies. And I'd like to end my comments with an example right here, homegrown example. In Portland, Oregon, there was an appraisal management company. It was started by 2 individuals. One of them is not a licensed appraiser in Oregon, and the other one is an appraiser who I might politely say has had a checkerboard passed in terms of disciplinary action with our board. This appraiser had received 2 sanctions, 2 separate board actions involving 3 different complaints, with 14 violations of professional practice, 3 violations of ethics rule, $7,750 in civil penalties assessed, which was reduced to $4,650, 75 hours of required education, 180-day suspension, which was waived and not served as part of a settlement, and a 2-year suspension from that appraiser having the ability to supervise a trainee. Okay, and this person is somebody who started an appraisal management company. Now, this bill does many things, but one of the things that we'll do is provide some method or some measure of requirements in order to, you know, to be a controlling person in an appraisal management company. And from here, I'm going to turn it over to Roxanne Gillespie.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Chair Hovey, Vice Chair Riley, thank you for having me today. I'm Roxanne Gillespie. I'm a fee independent appraiser in Eugene, Springfield area of Lane County. I've been appraising since 1985. I've been through the savings and loan bailout. I've been through our mini recession we had in the mid-1990s, and I'm going through this now as a small business owner. I'm also past chair of the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board. I served 8 years at the request of the governor, and I was the chair for 6 of those 8 years. I'm also currently the president of the Appraisal Institute for the Greater Oregon Chapter. It's a national organization that awards the 2 premier designations, the MAI designation and the SRA designation, and I hold the MAI designation. I've been an institute member for 20-some-odd years. I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 3624 and the necessity for it. The public and the appraisers, I think, need to know what they're dealing with when they are going to a lending institution and they are ordering, having appraisals ordered that affect the transactions that are going to occur. AMCs, appraisal management companies, are the only unregulated entity in the real estate valuation chain. We regulate appraisers. We have licensing laws for appraisers. We regulate lenders. We regulate mortgage brokers, people dealing in finance. Title insurance companies are regulated. So appraisal management companies are the one entity that is not regulated in this chain. Since the implementation of HVCC, which is the Home Valuation Code Conduct, the majority of appraisal assignments now are for lending purposes must be placed through appraisal management companies. the majority of loans in the state of Oregon through FHA, Fannie Mae, those have to go through AMCs. There is evidence mounting, and I have some evidence. We've gotten some comments from public, from realtors, from brokers, from mortgage brokers, from other appraisers. There's evidence that appraisal reports have been altered. There is evidence that appraisal reviews have been altered. And not to mention that those hired to do appraisal reviews may not always have a real estate background. There's a company called Street Links, which is a large AMC, and they recently posted a job posting to hire what's called a quality control person. Nowhere in that application does it ask what kind of real estate background the person has. While I'm not sure that the legislation will address this issue directly, I think it is worth pointing out that most AMCs are headquartered outside of Oregon. They take money, although indirectly from the lender, you know, from the Oregon consumer. Because as an Oregon consumer, I go to the lending institution, I tell them I want to buy this house. They say, fine, give us the appraisal money and we'll order the appraisal. The lender then hires an AMC to go out and order the appraisal. The AMCs take their cut anywhere from 40 to 60%. They take that cut outside of the state of Oregon, and then they pay Oregon residential appraisers a much lower price to do the appraisal assignment. For example, Columbia Community Credit Union paid $575 to an AMC to manage the appraisal. The appraiser was paid $250 for that assignment. The AMC kept the rest. Just wanted to bring that to your attention. The other thing to point out is that the AMC puts the appraisal assignment out to bid on an internet bidding process. They don't always pick the most qualified, competent person. Many times they'll pick the lowest bidder. And I'll give you an example from Eugene. There's a very exclusive part of Eugene called College Hill. The homes are old homes that have been renovated and have been updated and kept up. There was an appraisal ordered. The AMC hired someone from Portland who used comparables that were a mile away from the subject property. Within that mile range, the value difference was over $100,000 in value difference. So we're talking about geographic competency. Seven states have adopted AMC registration and regulation: Arkansas, California, Louisiana, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, North Carolina is almost done, and Florida is now in the process. There is also federal House Resolution 1728 that was passed in 2009, which requires states to register or regulate appraisal management companies in the public interest. So, to close, I just wanted to point this out. If funeral directors are needed to be licensed and regulated by our state, and they're working on the dead, why shouldn't AMCs also be regulated to assist in lenders making valuation and financial decisions?
Thank you. I appreciate you laying this out for us. I do have just a couple of questions in just going over this as it's been coming forward, and the draft hasn't been out all that long. You brought up an interesting point in that the AMC is required to do a review of the appraisal. Are you aware of whether this draft requires that review to actually be performed by a licensed appraiser?
Our draft does not require that. That's something to perhaps think about.
And that was something that just kind of jumped out at me. And the second part is, you know, in thinking about, because I talked to a couple of banks that have, you know, ended up actually having to pay twice for their appraisers and or appraisals, and also some other appraisers that haven't been paid themselves by appraisal management companies. And so I'm trying to figure out, you know, whether this bill's going to provide any protection to those individuals or institutions for their loss, and it dawned on me that we have a system of sometimes requiring a bond of certain types of industry or companies to make sure that they perform, or that there's some way somebody can recover some of their losses, perhaps. And I don't believe that's in this legislation either, but I think it might be something perhaps the appraisal board would consider talking about.
Excuse me, Chair Holvey, there is a provision in this bill which would require appraisal management companies to pay the appraiser within a 60-day time period after the service was rendered. And by the way, thank you for bringing up the issue about the bank from Southern Oregon. That was $34,000 they paid an appraisal management company who was then supposed to take those monies and pay the appraisers who did the work but didn't. That's the same appraisal management company I told you about up in Portland. A moment ago. Okay. Same outfit. Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting. We're dealing with some other pay-twice issues in this committee today as well. So, two thoughts. Other questions from the committee? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I sort of feel like I've been thrown in the middle of this, and I really don't understand this whole structure. So I just would like a brief outline of how all this works. So I know they're appraisers. So appraisal management company is something that hires various appraisers, and then the banks or real estate companies hire from the appraisal management company. Is that how that works?
Yes. The what happens is with the HVCC, Home Valuation.
You've got to give me words.
Home Valuation Code of Conduct. Okay. What happened was Home Valuation Code of Conduct said for appraiser independence, lending industry, you need to use an appraisal management company, and lending industry, you should not have contact with the appraiser. So you have the lending industry here, AMC here, and the appraiser over here.
Okay,
so the lending institutions call the AMC and say, hey, we need to have these properties appraised. The AMC then posts a web blast saying we have these properties that need to be appraised. And the appraiser, if they have paid a fee or if they are part of this accepted, approved appraiser for the AMC, they will get an opportunity to bid on these assignments. The AMC then takes those bids and looks at it and says, who should we hire?
So that's to create a firewall between the lending institution that wants to find out what a house is worth so they can provide a loan, and the appraiser. So is that correct?
Correct. They're the middle person. Yes, they are a middle person, supposedly creating that firewall, whereas that firewall has created many problems, as what I spoke to and as to what Bob Keith has spoken to as well.
Thank you. Thank you for that clarification.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow along the understanding of this, I understand it, but I'm just trying to help Representative Tomei. In Oregon, an AMC doesn't have to register as an appraiser. Is that correct?
Correct. There's no registration or regulation of AMCs at this point. Not even in Oregon. California, North Carolina, wherever they're coming from.
And a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Why wouldn't the federal legislation that you referenced fix that?
States' rights, they said. I asked them about that. They said it's states' rights. We want the states to be able to regulate and register appraisal management so that they have the enforcement capabilities for when something happens incorrectly.
Representative Wisnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Keith, I have a lot of information I need to ask about, so my office will contact you to be sure I understand this. And Mr. Chair, I think this is good. I still don't see it. I looked real fast. I don't see where the a lot of times it's not the bank or the credit union paying, it's a person paying that money. And I don't see any rights that you've outlined here for that person that makes the payment for the appraiser. Thank you.
Thank you. And I have just one final question or I guess. And that is do these appraisal management companies actually, are they in a position to impact or change the valuation that an appraiser comes up with?
Yes, they can. There is a time pressure that happens. Some AMCs only accept appraisals that are completed within 24 hours. That doesn't necessarily allow the appraiser on complex assignments to do the necessary research that's required.
Okay. If I may, Representative Holby, another way that appraisal management companies can influence the outcome is by continuing to go back to the appraiser and say, you know, your appraisal is not acceptable. Maybe it is, but they'll say, we need more comps, we need more recent comps, mm-hmm. we need, and they keep coming back. It's almost like a negotiation until they finally get what it is that they need or want.
Yeah, thank you. And last clarification on this firewall that you described that was the intent of the Home Valuation Code of Conduct. It seems like it really hasn't accomplished anything in, as far as creating a firewall, because now we need a firewall between the appraisal management company and the lender. And does not the appraisal certification and, you know, the appraisal industry has a set of standards that already provides for that, ethical separation or that firewall between the lender and their desired outcome to close a deal and the valuation that the appraiser provides?
Chair Holby, that is correct. The ethical standards for appraisers prohibit them from yielding to pressure from mortgage brokers, loan originators, appraisal management companies. However, and I'm not making excuses for appraisers, but I am, okay, from the standpoint that when you have four or five clients and one of them says, well, you know, Representative Holby, if you can't bring us in on this value, if you can't do this for us, then we just might have to take our business somewhere else. And frankly, oftentimes those words are never spoken, but they're communicated. And so appraisers do the wrong thing many times, and they yield to that pressure.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Representative Winger, I've gone way over my time, but since it was my bill, I suppose. Oh, and I have one other person to testify.
I just wanted to follow on that logic that we attempted to solve a problem and didn't really solve it. I'm wondering if we aren't headed in the same direction. The issue here is really about the standards for the appraiser. I guess the analogy that kept popping into my mind is, you know, lawyers, you know, they have to register and they have an ethical code they have to follow, but we don't require the law firm to register. We have a code of conduct that we expect the lawyers and people can file complaints, and they're expected, almost like mandatory reporters for child abuse, too. When you see something or you receive pressure, you know, it's something unethical, you're supposed to report it. So maybe the remedy here is more centered on what the conduct is for appraisers. If they are experiencing that pressure, maybe it should be part of the code that they report that. And, you know, I just wonder if we created the firewall and now we want to regulate the firewall. Maybe the firewall is really not even the issue, and maybe even should go away. The issue should be about how we hold appraisers accountable and the conduct that they're expected to adhere to, and maybe they need to be mandatory reporters if they experience any kind of pressure or pushback. You know, maybe it's not so much just that they, you know, shouldn't accede to pressure, but that they should be required to report it.
Who do I report that to? Who would I, as an appraiser, if I got pressure, where would I go for an AMC putting pressure on me?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I don't know. Is it the insurance or is it the banking, you know, DCBS, or is it your own appraisal board?
Let me interject here. Currently, they're not regulated, so there really isn't anybody to go to. That's one of the, I guess, the main points of this proposed legislation. And I really do need to move on, and because we'll have another opportunity to further discuss this. I had one more person signed up on this bill I wanted to give an opportunity to, and that was... I'm looking for your name. Excuse me. Mike Reed.
Thank you, Chair Holman.
Thank you.
Committee.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Certainly.
Thank you. Thanks, Bill. Thank you.
And Mr. Reed, if you can be brief, it would be helpful, but I know you took the time out of your day to show up, so I want to make sure you have an opportunity to speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives.
My name is Michael Reed. I'm a certified general appraiser in the states of Washington and Oregon, and you're looking at a victim of an AMC. I am owed over $8,000 by one AMC headquartered in Portland. I've filed a civil suit. I've got a judgment. I've filed a garnishment. I have not got my money. The victims on the other end of this deal are the state of Washington, who hired me to do $8,000 worth of appraisal, which I completed, and they paid the AMC. I have not seen a penny. The other client was a Oregon bank, Suslaw Bank, who I did two residential appraisals for, and they paid the appraisal management company. I did not get paid. That's why I filed the civil suit. I also helped the police department of Portland to follow up on their criminal complaints, and there's some real problems. Starting way back at HVCC, we hired the fox to look after the chickens. That's what the problem there was, and we've just got the chickens now who are laying half as many eggs and eating half as much food. The other thing is the law of unintended consequences has risen its ugly head here, and we've got a HVCC, which is totally useless and cuts appraisers' income down. I've been an appraiser since 1986, and I've never succumbed to pressure. But that doesn't matter. I'm tarred and feathered with everybody else, and my income has suffered accordingly. In my opinion, what we need here is no legislation. We need, very simple legislation, and that requires AMCs who handle other people's money to be required to purchase a bond of, or an insurance policy of some kind, so that when they disappear with the money, or when they cannot pay for whatever reason, the people who've supplied the services can be paid. I think that's pretty simple to do, and it doesn't require a host of people to look into their books or anything like that. The other thing, as I've read this draft very briefly, Mr. Holby, Representative Holby, and the one thing it doesn't do is trying to require the review process to be done in an AMC by a licensed person. That would be required if we went the route of regulating AMCs, because I have suffered under that review process, where the person that's reviewing your appraisal that you've spent 26 years figuring out how to do is somebody just hired off the street. They don't know what is going on, and they're reviewing your appraisal. So I'm going to end with that comment. I think the draft should, if it goes to the point of regulating the AMCs and changing all these laws, it should have a review process be done by a licensed and certified person. But I think they also should have to buy an insurance company to pay their bills if they don't pay.
Thank you, Mr. Reed.
I
agree with you on both those points. So we'll move forward, hopefully. With those suggestions. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3624 and I'm going to take about a 3-minute recess. I'd like to bring the House Interim Committee on Consumer Protection, Government Accountability back into order. And I just wanted to let people know that maybe did not hear at the beginning that if you do have a testimony that you would like to provide in writing, you know, I'm keeping all of these concepts open for a week to receive that public input in an effort hopefully to, you know, take a more comprehensive look at these before February starts. So with that, I am going to jump out of order, which I said I wasn't going to do unless something happened, and something did happen. So I'm going to jump into legislative concept 139, and so I'd like to open a public hearing on committee bill legislative concept 139.
Mr. Chair, question.
Representative Wisnant.
Is there no limit on the committee bills, and are these bills, you know, normally we just approve them and without a commitment to support them in the final?
I'll let Patrick answer that. I'm not sure what the limit is. These are all subject to the Speaker's approval.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, the list of the universe of potential committee bills was decided by deadlines that were set previously by the Speaker. They had to be submitted and approved for drafting. So LC drafts that the five LC drafts the committee has before it are the five that the committee can submit as committee bills. The date at which the committee will be voting on these, the first day of the February session, February 1st, each committee will meet for about 20 minutes. That meeting will be to adopt the committee rules for the February session and also to vote to introduce these as committee bills or to not introduce them as committee bills.
Thank you for that. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on legislative concept 139, commonly referred to as the pay twice lien issue, which committee, if you recall, some of you have been on this committee for a while, know that we've been working on the Construction Claims Task Force recommendations from 2005 and have went through a whole series of reviews of some of those recommendations, have implemented some of them, and some of them have not been successfully dealt with. And the pay twice lien issue was one of those that this committee passed out last session and overwhelmingly passed this committee and passed the House floor, got to the Senate, and there was many concerns brought to the Senate side from the industry and some legitimate concerns. I agreed to take a look at that, and the state bar was kind enough to step forward and say we would like to help you and hold a little work group amongst state bar members from different sections of the bar to look at this issue and see if there was some way to resolve some of these issues. You recall, we came up with a solution that simply said that if the consumers paid the general, the sub or the supplier then didn't really have a lien right against that consumer and had to go after the general whom they had the contractual relationship with to recover their funds, and that's called a derivative, from what I learned, a derivative lien state, which there are 17 states that operate that way. Oregon is not one of those. We are a direct lien state, and so we came back with the original concept from last year, which was to create an assistance fund that would be paid through either licensing or penalty monies to create a fund that would remove the lien and hold the consumer harmless and hopefully the sub and supplier harmless. But after further review and a lot of discussion amongst the state bar and legislative fiscal office and some other legislators and the Construction Contractors Board felt that assistance fund was not going to be very workable at this point. It has been tried in some other states, and most of those states, those funds have gone insolvent or have ended for various reasons, and some of those which were they underestimated the size of the problem, because not all of these cases are necessarily filed as claims with the CCB. They're either adjudicated with an attorney, and sometimes the consumer just ends up paying twice and walks away, figuring that's the least expensive route for him to go in these situations. So, having said that, I'm would like to call up Jeremy Vermilia, and I know there's somebody from the CCB here. I don't know if you would like to come up as well, or I know she's going to be available for questions, but I'm sure I'll have one.
Planning ahead.
and committee, the Construction Contractors Board also participated with the State Bar Work Group on this. We have had one stakeholder work group meeting here earlier this month on this issue to look over what we've ended up with, which is not exactly what we were proposing to start with. So with that, if you'd identify yourself for the record and correct all the misstatements I made.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeremy Vermilia. I'm a construction attorney from Tigard, and I appreciate the opportunity to provide you some input on the proposed legislation. I've submitted some written comments in the form of a memorandum as well as a red line of the draft LC concept. This work product came out after the bill came out, I believe, last Wednesday. We had a work session on it on Thursday. So we've had very little time to look at the bill. But fundamentally, after all of the background that you gave, there are basically four concepts that are embodied in the LC draft, and particularly in the red line. The initial draft had a number of problems with it that just didn't line up with the concepts that the work group had been talking about. So the red line submission is an attempt to try to really focus it in on what we had been working on. Basically, these concepts are the ability that it will eliminate the bill would eliminate the ability of home sellers to exempt or waive their obligations under ORS 87.007, otherwise known as the Home Buyer Protection Act. There's a provision in that bill that essentially allows, there's about five or six requirements when a seller sells a home to ensure that a buyer isn't going to have liens or other problems after the closing of the sale. But there's a provision that says if you sign a form, you're essentially waiving your rights under those protections. This bill would eliminate the ability to waive those rights. And my understanding from having talked to a couple of folks that are involved in the title insurance business is that what basically happens in practice now is that early issue title insurance is issued, and it protects the home buyers from the possibility that there will be liens within 75 days after the close of the sale, 75 days being the amount of time that a contractor has to record a lien after they complete their work. So essentially what this is doing is requiring now sellers to procure either early issue title insurance or do one of the other things that are laid out in that in the Protection Act and avoid the potential of a waiver situation, which then opens up a purchaser to the possibility that they would have a post-closing lien. Excuse me. The second thing that the bill will do is require so-called downstream parties, that is, subcontractors and suppliers who are providing either services, materials, or equipment on a residential remodel, to check the licensing status of a party for whom they are providing services or supplies. The exception to that being if the party providing the services or supplies is paid in cash or with consumer credit at the time the services are prior to the time that the service or supplies are provided. In other words, this is designed to get primarily at suppliers providing supplies on account to unlicensed contractors, and then later leaning a project where the owner may have already paid either a prime contractor or a subcontractor. The idea is, if you don't check the license status at the time you enter into the agreement to provide the services or supplies, and that contractor turns out to be unlicensed, you then lose your lien rights. So it puts the onus on the downstream party to do a little bit of homework at the time they enter into an agreement with somebody to provide services or supplies to ensure that they are, in fact, licensed as a contractor before they provide that. And as I said, this is limited to residential remodels. I don't know that you talked about this, so I'll take a slight detour. In the course of these three work sessions that we had, became apparent that the majority of the problem that we have with respect to the twice pay issue arises out of the modification, alteration, or repair of existing residential units. And the reason for that is essentially that when you're talking about, let's say, a large-scale subdivision or development, you have lenders involved. Lenders hire outside contractors or outside construction managers to look at the documentation, the payment requests, to ensure that lien releases are obtained, to ensure that subcontractors and suppliers get paid. So there's a layer of protection already in existence at that level. And with respect to even a single family or a single home, a custom home, for example, when you have the early issue title insurance in place, which is now going to be something that will be required, or something like it, you now essentially have a backstop in case there are liens that do get filed. You have another party who is going to either step in and take care of that lien, or you've got cash in a in an escrow account, which is one of the other remedies under that Home Buyer Protection Act. So the Home Buyer Protection Act kind of takes care of the home sale side of it, which leaves really the remodel side of it that is still vulnerable to the twice pay issue. And so that's really what we tried to focus on when we were trying to come up with the remedies here. So again, we have the requirement that you check license status. Then you have we have a standardized lien release form that is in the red line version of the bill. The LC draft didn't capture the requirement, which is you need four forms to be able to cover progress payments and final payments, both conditional and unconditional payments. So we've got a standardized form. The reason for that is there are every contractor in the state's got a lien form, and every one of them is different, and they're very difficult to understand sometimes, even for the lawyers that are involved. This idea basically says there is one set of lien forms. Everybody's going to use them. And we'll be able to develop a set of case law interpreting these lien forms, the release forms, and we think that it will encourage people and basically get the use of lien release forms into better practice and more common practice. And then finally, the fourth concept is a limitation on the amount of upfront deposits. And this is, I think, still the subject of some controversy, and I think is going to still need to be the subject of some discussion. As the red line lays out basically three tiers at which there are different percentages, maximum percentages that a contractor can require for an initial deposit. There's an exception if they can demonstrate that they have to pay for materials. It's going to be very difficult, I think, to dial the language into this to make it workable. We've left it in the bill, pursuant to the discussion that you and I had, Mr. Chair, after the last conversation with everybody, but I think there are some legitimate concerns about whether this is really workable, and I know others are going to speak to that, but I share some of those concerns. The language is there so that, it can be talked about. Another concept that we did not leave in pursuant to our conversation was we took out the requirement for retention on a residential remodel project. There is already in ORS 701 the right to retain funds out of what otherwise would be owed to a contractor on a progress payment basis. Those funds can be used to pay for liens. They can be used to pay for warranty issues if those things come up, et cetera. So it's already within the parties' abilities to contract with one another with respect to retention. There are some other issues with the LC concept that we had concerns about. one of them being the general issue of the so-called cleanup. In this particular bill, I think the cleanup actually creates more problems and confusions confusion than it helps. As you may recall, a few years ago, we rewrote virtually the entire chapter of OR 701. And now we're only, you know, 3 years later and changing a lot of language. It really isn't germane to this lien issue. My view and the view of the lawyers who weighed in on this, and I think the view of some other stakeholders, is at this time the bill would be better served not to have all of that language cleanup in it. We ought to go back to just focusing on these basic concepts. There are some other things that I wrote in my memo that I think ought to come out, and they are part of that cleanup issue. But the one that is really not is the idea of making this an emergency bill. I think that's problematic because if we're going to particularly go to the idea of requiring the initial check of the license, you've got to give time for the industry to become aware of that. You need the trade associations to be able to talk to their members and make them understand that this is now an affirmative obligation, that they may be losing lien rights. And that, I think, augurs towards not making this an emergency bill, but letting it become law in the normal course. And with that, I'll close my testimony. The rest in more detail is in the memorandum and the red line that I've submitted, but I'm happy to answer any questions if any of the committee members have some.
Thank you. I have one question for the CCB, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I'm Kathy Dahling. I'm the policy analyst for the Construction Contractors Board, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
I have one because I know it was actually the Construction Contractors Board that sort of flagged this issue of being able to implement this bill with an emergency clause, and so I was curious, you know, what do they see as you know, saying parts of this bill get through, how far out does the Construction Contractors Board think is prudent for a bill like this to get implemented?
Representative Holvey, members of the committee, I think Jeremy made some good points regarding having the industry come on board, understand what their requirements are. We also have a technology-based a solution for people who want to find out the status of a contractor's license. It's currently used by our contractors. It's called eWatch, and it's part of another system that we have, eLicense. We think we could make that available to the general public, which would include, for example, material suppliers, so that there would be an actual notification to these people as to the status of contractor's licenses they wanted to keep a watch on. And that would be a very good service to interface with this bill. The problem, though, is we need to be able to design the technology to do that. The IT architecture is going to take a little bit of time. It's also going to take a bit of time because we have a payment, an electronic payment methodology that the state treasurer, and I believe U.S. Bank requires about 8 weeks' notice before we actually implement. So it's just some practical issues for us. If we could have, as Jeremy suggested, for a non-emergency bill, that should give us plenty of time to do whatever we need to do, and I think the industry as well.
So, and another question, Jeremy or whoever can answer it, is that piece still in the bill that gives the Construction Contractors Board the ability to collect a fee so that they could afford to provide that service to others that are outside the construction contractors license?
Representative Holvey, I'll answer it this way. If it was in the bill, I didn't take it out.
Okay.
I don't recall specifically the language because there were other things that I was focusing on. We did not delete that, so if it was originally in the draft, it's still there.
Okay. Good enough. I'll take that. Other questions? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I don't understand. So where are we, or Patrick, as far as what is this?
This is the original draft that we're looking at, which I believe is
10-1-4-139.
After our last stakeholder work group, there was some issues with that, and so we're back at the drawing board with it and actually culling out a few pieces in it and trying to come up with a bill that we can get some agreement from the industry on.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So when can we have, can we get this electronically whenever you come up with what we're going to have so we could send that to our local?
Well, right now we just have LC-139 available electronically, and I would prefer to wait till we have it redrafted along this working piece before we, you know, and have the stakeholders really weigh in on this before we put together a final piece. And it's a short time frame to get this accomplished, and I'm not missing that point. So I know I'm sort of up against the wall a little bit on that, but we'll get it out as soon as we possibly can.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
The lady from the Construction Contractors Board, I would encourage you to put the eWatch link on Oregon.gov, what is it, Representative Smith, /transparency?
Yep.
Immediately, if not sooner.
Representative Holvey, Representative Wisnut, I am not sure of the technology of doing that and whether that can be done. I think, as I understand it from talking to our IT people, we still have quite a lot of work to do before the eWatch can be made available to the general public. It's not set up to work that way. So we've got several steps to go through to design
that. As soon as
possible.
Thank you.
Well, and I believe it is basically paid for through the licensing fees of the Construction Contractors Board, and it was developed to serve that community and not really serve the public, if I'm not mistaken.
It's tied to the licensing records that we have right now. So everything's tied into the license stuff. We don't have it as a separate program. It will have to be developed as a separate program.
So with that, I appreciate your testimony. Oh, Representative Krieger, question?
Well, I'm concerned. I've got a house half built. And I've got the roof on. I got another $3,000 worth of roofing sitting there for a very elaborate porch. I hope the subcontractor paid for the roofing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, my suggestion is that you require your general contractor to provide you with a copy of a lien release that he's gotten from his subcontractor so that you don't end up in a pay-twice scenario.
He's going to bill you for that, too.
I'd use my card at the conclusion of the hearing. Representative Holvey, I provided Patrick with an electronic version of this red line, which is now superseded because I was tinkering with it this morning after I'd already sent it to him. So I will get you an updated version of this as soon as I get back to my office this afternoon.
Yeah,
so that can be submitted to LC for an updated draft.
Right. That's our next step, is to try to work on an updated draft. And I'm sure you've shared it with some of the other members of the State Bar and the Construction Contractors Boards had input on it as well.
Well, they had input on it at the last meeting we had. Literally, this red line came about 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. So it's been a very short amount of time that we've had to be working on this. But we are going to be distributing it the same time I send it to Patrick.
And my sincere thanks to you and the State Bar that have volunteered to spend some time with this issue. Really appreciate it. And I'm sure we'll hear more about this issue.
And Representative Holvey, we also would like to prepare a couple small changes we'll send to Patrick real shortly.
Great. So. Great.
Try to keep track of all those, Patrick.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next up, I'd like to have Brian Krieg, Scott Berry, and James Morales. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here to testify on this bill. I know some of you at least have been engaged for quite a while on this issue, so if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please. Whoever wants to go first.
Sure. Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association. And I'll first just start off by saying I have spent some time working on this issue over the many years, and with regard to this particular latest red line draft, I haven't even gone through it yet. We just got it just less than an hour ago, so I haven't spent too much time going through it. I did have time to peruse Mr. Vermilia's summary, if you will, and I can tell you that they're numbered. If you turn to page, at the bottom of page 1 and page 2 of that, there's four particular pieces broken out, and I won't go through them in particular, but one deals with waiving the rights or a lien waiver notice from the subcontractors and suppliers. That's something that's used today, but they're not uniform, so that would potentially help. It talks about the suppliers not selling on credit, and I think that's the key piece to unlicensed contractors for work on a project or a job, and checking that license, and I think checking it just at the beginning of when that process begins, not having to put the onus on them to continue to check it, because they don't necessarily know how long that construction project is going on. And then finally, we still have some concerns about 1, 2, and 3. The last one I would talk about is the sub F of the lien law that we worked on for new construction a number of years ago, which would not allow the consumer to waive their right to the lien, and that originally came about because we had homeowners facing a charge of $500 to $1,000 for that lien insurance, that early issue insurance, and we had contractors who'd never had a project liened, and they'd never had a claim with the Construction Contractors Board, so the homeowner was choosing to not pay that additional $1,000 for protection. I understand where that could be a benefit. I'm not sure it's a major issue or problem, but I'm not sure that we would have problems removing that either. We're working on that right now with inside the association. The one we would have, I think, real concerns are on with is four, and Mr. Vermilia talked about that. That's the deposit. Setting that for different projects gets very, very difficult when you've got potentially a bunch of windows coming out that have a very high cost and not so much of a cost in installing them. You might have to, you know, get 80 or 90% of the money up front because only 10% is labor. Those kinds of issues really limit how you set that up, and then I think our folks had just a general concern about government stepping in and saying, here's how much you can take on these particular types of projects, and even limiting it to three or four different categories makes it very difficult. So I think the other three we're willing to work on. It depends on the wording and how things look, but number four we have some major concerns with. And I didn't specifically refer to this, although I will tell you that the fee piece for the Construction Contractors Board is still in both versions of the bill. So.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Brian Krieg here today representing the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association and the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association. We, too, have been involved with the lien laws issue for many years. Kind of echoing a little bit of what Scott was saying, there are some of the elements in the measure in front of you that we think are good ideas and should maybe move forward. With a little bit of tweaking, there's a couple of them within it that I think most of the group and during the work group came to some conclusions that were not very workable. So we are looking forward to continuing to work on this. I haven't gotten the look at the red line yet, and we know that this is going to be a hurry-up project on one hand, but we have to be very careful in what we're doing. This is a very challenging area of law for our contractors and the consumers, and we need to do this right. And in noting that, I would like to pull us back to about 4 years ago. We spent a significant amount of time at that time redoing the standards for how we divide up the construction industry in our licensing and standards, and we rewrote a whole lot of code in that area. In the draft that you have in front of you, the LC draft, there is an incredible amount of rewriting of language that was added to that for cleaning up purposes. I'm hoping that we do not see any of that in the next draft. We need to get down to the actual issues on here. The language that was put together during that process 4 years ago was up to the current standards of legal counsel at that time and is very nuanced. And there's many places in the current bill, if you were reading through all those things, that there's things that are actually turned upside down by the language changes. So I'm hoping that we can get a more streamlined bill out that we can all understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, James Morales, Benton County Clerk, representing the Oregon Association of County Clerks. We are the records keepers for the constructions lien, so when we saw this bill, and we did not have the opportunity to participate, but we're just trying to learn about it, attending this meeting, so I haven't seen the red line version, but the questions that did come to mind in what we were had our chance that we did have to review this was first, what exactly were they trying to accomplish? And Second, on the forms that that were created, we were wondering if they wanted to record these, and if they did want to record the waiver and the and release of lien, was it a waiver or was it a release? What is the lien number? You know, part of the form should be that we need to know the original recording number for the lien that they are releasing or waiving the right to. These types of things, just some, so that we know who's going to be required to sign. Is it the contractor, the subcontractor, both, the property owner? Not clear. I think it needs to be clarified also that it would go in the, if it is recordable, that it would go in the county clerk's lien record along with the other construction lien. And the second form, I don't believe the notice of right to retain payment form, we weren't sure if that was something they would intend on recording at all, and if they aren't, I think it should be clear that, that there's no intention to record that particular document or not. Or so just some clarification on those forms and what the intent and whether they are a waiver or a release, because a release, that we already have a release for a construction lien. So if we're, if it's a waiver and a release, I think that creates confusion.
Well, thank you. We'll make sure that we get some clarification for the County Clerk Association on where this is at. We've been working on this issue for a couple of sessions at least on this construction lien issue, and so a lot of folks have been working on this, and we'll get the clarification and make sure your questions get answered.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
If I could be of any help, sure.
Yeah. Mr. Berry, another comment?
Just one additional comment. Chair Holby, as you and I have talked, the early issue title insurance really took care of this issue for new construction. Now we're dealing with the remodeling issues, and there's been some talk about having the title folks look into a similar type of insurance for remodeling, and that's still ongoing. It may be a potential solution that if you purchase something like that, which of course protect the consumer completely against a lien, you could be, you know, sort of exempt from all these other requirements. Something we can continue to talk
right.
about, but certainly that takes care of the consumer completely.
Yeah, thank you. I know that conversation is ongoing, and I'll have to double check with the folks at the State Bar to see if they've had time to digest all of that. Not seeing any questions, and appreciate your testimony and your participation in this process. We'll see what happens. With that, I will close the public hearing on legislative concept number 139, and I am going to go out of order yet again, and I think I'm going to open... she was going to be here at 3:15. So,
which one? Was
it one? I'm going to open up a public hearing on legislative concept number 137. So, committee, legislative concept 137. Before you, I believe, let me catch up here and go out of order and all things happen. This bill addresses foreclosed properties that go into neglect after being foreclosed, and so it provides some tools for local governments to assess penalties to try to prevent the deterioration of properties and communities. And up first, I have Representative Stiegler and Representative Frederick. Thank you very much for being here this afternoon, and I think both of you are familiar with this issue, and appreciate you coming forward to testify on it. So if you'd identify yourself for the record.
All right. I am Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Judy Sigler. I'm the representative from District 54, which represents the city of Bend and down into Deschutes River Woods, and you say that quickly three times and you can't talk. I'm here today, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, to speak regarding this issue, as I'm sure there's no secret that Oregon has felt the full force of foreclosure crisis and that Bend in particular has been greatly impacted. You can't walk down a street in Bend, basically, or through a neighborhood, but that you don't run across foreclosed property, quite frankly. Many of these homes, now owned by banks or other entities, have been neglected and are in disrepair. It's a great and growing problem in the Bend area. It is a problem for the families trying to sell their homes and for those families wishing to remain in the community. Foreclosed homes, especially those that are not maintained, lower the morale of the hard-hit communities that they exist in. And when you have empty homes on a block anyway, you have the sense of community within those neighborhoods dissipates. Every time there's a broken window, there's an overgrown lawn, there are weeds in the driveway, or it impacts the feeling of neighborhood in those different areas. Those families who are trying to sell their homes before they fall into delinquency themselves or face foreclosure have an even greater difficulty, because what happens in these areas is that already significantly decreased property values see additional reduction in those values. The property values are actually driven down by the condition of the neighborhoods. So you may have a once attractive neighborhood that becomes blighted with overgrown lots and homes in disrepair. LC 137 would require banks or others as the owners of foreclosed homes to keep up the property or face daily fines imposed by local government. It's a simple bill. It just takes and asks these folks to do their part in maintaining the neighborhoods that they do business in. It is merely providing a tool for local governments to be able to give some semblance of, I guess, security to those neighborhoods, that something can be done other than just walking away and abandoning these properties. Coincidentally, this is an issue which has been raised by several of my constituents recently, because I think what we've got in Bend in particular, but in Deschutes County in general, is a growing foreclosure rate. We've got one of the highest in the nation, and we've got a growing problem with these foreclosed properties. As I said, you can't walk through a neighborhood but that you don't see multiple foreclosures or for sale signs, most of which are, or a good portion of which are abandoned or foreclosed properties. The blame does not lie with a single bank, a single institution, or a single person, but with the system as it currently stands. If a bank or other entity or a person is going to foreclose on a property and take it over ownership of that property, then they should be responsible for its upkeep. That's as simple as this bill is. And again, this bill doesn't mandate it, at least my reading of it doesn't mandate it. It just is another tool in the quiver of local governments to be able to do something about these situations. So that's why I support the concepts contained in LC 137 and hope that you take it and move it forward.
Thank you, Representative Frederick.
Thank you very much, Chair Holvey. Vice Chairman, Chair Gilliam, good to see you today.
Good to see you. Thank you very much.
And Vice Chair Riley, good to see you too.
Identify yourself.
I am Lou Frederick. I'm State Representative Lou Frederick. I'm my district, House District, is District 43 in North and Northeast Portland. And I have lived there since 1977, so I have a sense of how this district works there. To the other members of the Consumer Protection Committee, thank you very much for allowing me to speak. I'd like to speak a little bit about LC 137 as well, and Portland's experience with foreclosed homes and blighted neighborhoods. This is frankly a real problem in Portland. especially the Northeast District that I represent. It has been a problem for years, and one that's only been made worse by the current housing crisis. Neglected properties foster increased crime, squatting, vandalism, drug use, and fires. They set back the hard work we're undertaking to restore the pride in our communities. The concepts contained in LC 137 would give localities an additional tool to help us solve these challenges. And it will allow local governments to require banks and other owners of foreclosed properties to perform upkeep or face fines of up to $1,000 per day. If implemented, this would go a long way to making banks live up to their obligations as good neighbors. And for that reason, I happen to support LC 137. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Krieger?
I've been into some of those neighborhoods, and I've seen even in rural Oregon houses that they were in that condition before foreclosure. In other words, they were overgrown, nothing was maintained, and windows were broken. And then, for some reason, they lose the house, they move out. Then you'd be requiring probably the mortgage holder to come in and remedy what was a pre-existing condition of the house, the property.
Representative Krieger, Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I don't read the bill that way. I suppose that would there is latitude within this bill for the foreclosing entity, whether it's a bank or a private or some other institution or private person, to have some kind of interchange with the and as I read it, the city would have the ability to have an exceptions clause. I don't read this as an ironclad thing. And I guess what I would add, at least my experience in the Bend area, is this situation has become, we're not talking about an occasional house here and there that somebody isn't keeping up. I mean, this is literally house upon house, block upon block in some of these neighborhoods. And these are houses that had previously been occupied, had decent homes, they were a neighborhood, and they have now been abandoned, and they are in a total state of disrepair.
Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. First, let me just say, Representative Frederick, it's really delightful to have you here. And personally, and I think institutionally, you're a huge asset, and personally, it's really just wonderful to have you. Representative Krieger's question was a really, really good one. My reading of the bill, speaking to the record, to the extent that informs some legislative intent, is interesting to me that it first says failure to maintain the buildings, which I would read as different than failure to improve buildings. Second, I also take note that the examples they offer, growth of foliage, trespassers or squatters, and larvae in standing water, as conditions that would suggest that what a local government might do, because again, it doesn't require but allows, is say we might require some reasonable improvement if it's the kind of condition that gets worse. Wouldn't ask you to build a new fence or repaint a house, right, or develop new windows, but if there's something there that's getting worse by the day, you need to mow the lawn or trim the hedge or take out the standing water or some very reasonable things. We might want to consider some amendment that says, in the case of pre-existing conditions, only reasonable efforts or something. There might be something that we might want to explore like that. My comment is this impacts my district. I know other districts across the state as well, but it's a significant issue. I appreciate you bringing it. The question I have is, I apologize for having two. I'll ask them in order. First, why the sunset in 2014?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I don't know, since it's not my bill.
Okay. Why the sunset in 2014?
That's as simple as.
Good question. I might interject that I think the bill was set to be reviewed in 2014 as we come out of this
recession,
and hopefully foreclosed properties are still not huge in our communities, and and bring it back for the legislature and see if it's really
if it's working,
really a workable situation that needs to continue.
And second and last question, what are the rules now? I mean, my vague understanding, which as a relatively new homeowner, I should probably have a more clear understanding, is that if I, in my own home, were allowed some of this stuff to happen, that the locality could come in and say, hey, you're not allowed to keep, you know, your car on blocks, you're not allowed, or, you know, only, you know, three or less, or, you know, you're only allowed to have, you're not allowed to have that standing water, which is festering your neighbor's, you know, the mosquito-free zone. Are we allowed to, you know, what are generally the standards now, and are those standards different for a person who owns the property through foreclosure, or is it merely that through practice they don't live there, so there's less likely to do it and it's harder to hold them accountable?
There's a process,
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith,
so that's not covered.
With respect to my understanding is currently these would have to be brought under a city or county's nuisance ordinances.
Right.
And, you know, those probably vary as much as many cities and counties that there are in the state. Generally speaking, those are, you know, you have code enforcement officers. Those apply to, you know, the current property owner, that kind of thing. I think this becomes very problematic for local governments because they don't quite know how to deal with it because they don't have, you know, live warm bodies sitting in the house that they can go say, hey, you need to get that, you know, it's against the city ordinance, it's considered a nuisance to have that car jacked up on the block sitting on the curb or sitting by the curb kind of thing. They don't have that same kind of interplay. So my understanding, this whole issue originally came to my attention through some constituents who were stopped me literally in places like Fred Meyer, who said, you guys got to do something about this. Our neighborhoods are, you know, and there's nobody for them to go to complain to. They can't go to the city because the city doesn't know what to do with it. They can't go to the neighbor because the neighbor's not there. So they see it as a conundrum that nobody seems to quite have the answer to. And when I saw this draft coming down the pike, I thought at least it's a step towards the right direction of trying to address an issue that, you know, everybody just sort of seems to wring their hands about and say you got to go talk to the other guy.
Chair Hovey and Representative Smith, I come at it from another direction in some ways. I've seen both this kind of a problem in my district, but also in places like Burns. Back in the 1980s, I saw the same kind of foreclosure issue take place and find that they did not quite know what to do with it because the city did not have a sense of the policy that was available to them, and this gives them a sense of doing that. In the district that I'm in, I at one point was able to, in a very small block area, a small set of blocks, count 100 empty or abandoned homes because they had been. This is in the early 90s. That had foreclosure issues surrounding them. Some of those places are still being worked on, but in many cases it took the city doing its nuisance effort and really an effort to go after the companies that were allowing them to be the foreclosure to take place. So this happens to be a direction that's very, I think, would help a great deal, both in an urban and in a rural situation.
Thank you. I appreciate the testimony, and we'll certainly have more time to discuss this. I have one more person signed up and sort of reaching my time threshold. Thank you very much for testifying on LC 137. I have Paul Cosgrove up. Okay. Then I will close the public hearing on legislative concept 137. I'll just note that Mr. Cosgrove did sign up against the legislative concept 137. With that, I'll close the public hearing on legislative concept 137. And next up, we have, I know there were some that were waiting for 138. I saw Scott Berry just a second ago, and now I don't. So I will open, is he out there? I'm going to open the public hearing on legislative concept number 138. Committee, this bill was also a recommendation from the past of the Construction Claims Task Force that this committee dealt with. We had previously passed a bill, I believe in 2007, that did require home builders or of new homes to offer a warranty, and subsequent to that, I've done a little legwork and found that it really wasn't accomplishing much in that regard, and there was still some issues with wanting to come forward with some sort of bill that would provide a home warranty on newly constructed residential property. Of that, it's a little bit more complicated than I guess you would generally think. You know, at you look at warranties. You get one on a new car, and a lot of other products have warranties on them. But the state of Oregon currently does not offer new home warranties, and or does not require them. I know that it is possible that some builders do offer them on their properties. But it was concept of Chair felt that it was worth exploring this bill again. Got some input from other legislators who thought that this would be a good bill to bring forward. So with that, I have Scott Berry and Brian Krieg signed up. If you would like to come forward and testify.
Good afternoon again, Scott Berry with the Oregon Home Builders Association, and let me just start by saying I wanted to sound like I was really interested in working on that first bill so that I could come up on this second bill and say how much we dislike it and that we'd rather not spend a bunch of time working on it. I'm not aware of any other state that has anything like this in any way, shape, or form. We have a number of concerns, having just got it about an hour ago, but It was an issue that came up during the construction claims task force. There was a requirement that we offer a warranty. Our builders do offer warranties. They are of any number of different coverages and years. Many of them offer, in fact, a 210 type warranty or a basically it's 2 years on a number of the things that I think under this particular bill are covered for 5 and then 10 years on all structural issues. And that's something they can find on the market and purchase so that if they, for instance, want to retire or leave the industry, they can actually do that and have those insurance products there to make sure that homeowner is still taken care of, as opposed to really being on the hook for 5 or 10 years after with no way to cover that, because I don't know of anything on the market that would cover what this particular bill requires. Having said that, I know it's an early draft, we're, without going into a lot of detail and making it quick, it's late in the day, we have a number of problems with it. It says things like a defect is something that results in a dwelling unit not meeting a specification of the state building code, and then talks about actually covering workmanship for 5 years, but doesn't define workmanship. So those are some things that really concern our industry. I'll leave it at that and take any questions.
Mr. Krieg.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Brian Krieg representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association and the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association. As two of the crafts that are mentioned within the bill, and I have not really had a chance to look at this bill at all in any in significant depth, I share some of the same concerns that Scott has mentioned just previously. The workmanship issues are something that's very subjective, and how that would be dealt with once it's passed the certain amount of time with the CCB that's be going out, we're talking about a lot of legal issues here, and could be a very expensive thing, very difficult for our industry to be able to financially prepare for. And one of the things I would like to note is that about 8 years ago, one of the national associations for subcontractors actually looked into doing some extended warranties for the work of their contractors and workers, as they viewed that as a potential opportunity to gain back much market share in the residential environment if they could do that. And they progressed very a long ways with the development of that. But in the long run, that project and the
concept of it collapsed because of the legal implications and the financial implications that were there. They really couldn't come to a situation with the finance folks to be able to do the type of insurance and the, putting the monies together behind it, and then and a lot of it was based on what are those standards that would be applied. It wasn't quite in length, it wasn't 5 years, I think it was somewhere closer to three, but, that they were looking at. But as I say, looking at it from trying to use it as a marketing tool to gain market share, they couldn't make it work in the free market viewpoint at all. So,
thank you. Appreciate appreciate the testimony. So, one question. So, absent any kind of warranty for the homeowner, then in a bill like in today's world, you know, what kind of protections does a new home buyer have as far as you know, the workmanship or defects that come up in a house that. A brand new house that they just bought 2 years ago, for example, or 3 years ago, for example.
Scott Berry again with the Oregon Home Builders. Representative Holby, as you probably all know, there's the one-year Construction Contractors Board process from years actually 1 to 10, because you can go around that process. We're on the hook with liability and liability insurance. I don't know of any of our general contractors that have liability insurance under $1 million policy, and that's 10 years, or I think 2 years from discovery, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not an attorney, but that's really the and believe me, in talking to the insurers, that's accessed on a regular basis.
And you're speaking of the one-year implied warranty?
No, I'm speaking of the 10-year statute of repose.
Statute of repose. Okay. Thank you. Don't see any other questions. Appreciate your testimony. With that, I'll close the public hearing on legislative concept number 138. I'd like to reopen the hearing on legislative concept 137. Call up Mr. Cosgrove. I already informed everybody that you signed up opposed to the legislative concept. If you could very briefly state your mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. I was down in another committee hearing. I apologize. There are two concerns. One is, I am aware that many local governments in Oregon have ordinances that deal with nuisances. I know Representative Tomei is a former mayor of a city that near where I grew up. It was probably had a number of nuisance complaints that came before the city council. And there's no objection for any owner, where it be a financial institution after foreclosure or any other owner, being subjected to whatever standards the city has or county has imposed for nuisances. I think there's some concern about having a special set of standards just for a certain kind of owners and the potential. In other words, we'd like to comply with whatever laws everybody else has to comply with respect to nuisances. Separately, I think if the bill does go forward, there are a number of concerns, and it may be because this came, as I noted in the summary that the committee had, from a California piece of legislation. That may be part of the reason there are concerns. But in some cases, this would impose duties on a foreclosing lender before the lender had the legal right to have possession and therefore remedy the problems. And so there's some significant technical problems with respect to the bill. And I'd be happy as the process goes forward to get into detail. But I appreciate the opportunity just to raise those issues today.
Thank you. I'm sure we'll have a conversation about that. With that, I appreciate your testimony.
Close
the public hearing on legislative concept 137 and open a public hearing on legislative concept 136. So, Committee Legislative Concept 136 comes to you as the chair. I brought this bill back forward. It actually was a bill that came, a similar bill came out of this committee last session, House Bill 3004, went to the floor, and there were some concerns from the sponsor of the bill, and the bill was referred back to rules, and rules did some major changes to the bill and changed the intent of what this committee had passed, and also caused a few other problems. And I've heard from many a few attorneys, especially, and some CPAs about some of those unintended impacts of the legislation from last session. So this bill tries to correct those and also returns the intent back to the bill. And what the bill tried to address was essentially a situation where a consumer goes to purchase a home and ends up with a first and second as part of a loan product for that purchase. And subsequently, they can find themselves financed at 100% or more, oftentimes, or maybe less. But they're commonly referred to as 80-20 loans. And so in the foreclosure process, they are not treated as a single loan product. They are actually treated as, under current law, a first and second. And so the foreclosure process would go forward and foreclose on either the first or second, and then the lender would then sue the homeowner for the remaining deficiency, and usually putting that person into further dire need. And so it was the original intent, I believe, of this legislation to make sure that when lending institutions want to put out 100% financing or 120% financing, especially to somebody who may not be able to afford it, that they actually are putting a risky loan product forward and should take some of the risk. And so the bill essentially was supposed to have not allowed them to sue on the remaining deficiency after the foreclosure of either the first or second. And in the Rules Committee, there was a provision that was put in that required that the first and second be owned by the same lender, which in today's world, I've gotten many, many emails about this bill and about that particular loophole, because it doesn't apply very often in today's world, where the first and seconds are oftentimes sold and owned by different lenders. So that was the purpose of this bill, and as well as to correct the impact to commercial properties, which was unintended. So with that, that's a description of LC 136. And you have testimony from Sybil Hebb before you from the Oregon Law Center, written testimony. And I have signed up Tim Martinez. Welcome, Mr. Martinez. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I was ecstatic when you said you were going to go in order. I'm not sure that worked out. I'm not trying not to take it personal. I am here to talk about LC 136, and I would, if I may, Mr. Chairman, just add a couple of comments here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. House Bill 3004, we spent a lot of time on that bill last session, along with other members of the United Financial Lobby, which would be the credit unions, Mr. Cosgrove's group, the mortgage brokers and the mortgage bankers. So virtually all the lenders were involved in these discussions. This bill did come from Representative Clem, and it was targeted specifically at a problem that he was made aware of down, I think, in Eugene, where the problem was indeed a builder and was making loans at 100%. He was doing 80-20s to help people qualify. And I certainly wouldn't disagree with the chair's comments that perhaps some of those people that he was trying to qualify probably would not have qualified under more stricter underwriting standards. But that was the problem he was trying to solve. Like happens occasionally, especially when bills are kind of run through the last week. There were some things in there that I think LC 136 has appropriately found and you try to fix. One of that was the residential language that you are taking out. We're fully supportive of that. We did change the notice to received, and that was a big change. You've now changed that back to given. We support that as well. I think I understand what you're trying to do. The third change that we've identified is right now the bill says that it has to be created at the same time, and that has given the legal profession some heartburn, and your, or at least the drafter's preferred change would be within 30 days. We think that you can get what you're trying to get at with some language that would say perhaps as part of the same transaction, so that you know, solves the problem, rather than, we think the 30-day language would be problematic to people going out and getting seconds immediately after getting into their home. As far as the first and second made by the same lender, I think that's probably where we do part company a little bit, in that that was really the key component and the key compromise that we reached with the sponsor of the bill, Representative Clem. I've not had a chance to visit with him since this draft has come out. I will certainly do that. But as this bill worked through its process, both in the House and this committee and the Rules Committee, and then over in the Senate, that was certainly a very, very key piece. As it solves the problem that Representative Clem had identified. So I know it's late. I know you've been here a long time. I know you're going to give me another chance in February, but that's kind of where we're at. Some of these we think are good changes and are needed changes, especially this last one on made by the same lender is very difficult for us to work with, because that was our key compromise with the sponsor of the bill.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You did a really great job of pointing out how the bill came about, and I too have problems with the within the 30 days thing as well. I don't think that's a workable situation. Wasn't what I was intending either. So definitely we'll be looking for a change in that if that piece goes forward.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So I appreciate your testimony. I do fully intend on making sure this bill gets through to at least fix the problems that you and I have both identified, as well as I've got so many emails on this piece of legislation from attorneys and CPAs and quite a few others about that impact on commercial property that wasn't, I believe, intended with the trust deeds.
Right.
So with that, I appreciate your testimony. Questions from the committee? Representative Comey.
Thank you. Tim, you were referring to by the same lender. Where is that in the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tomei, it's actually, it's, you know, legalese, so it's hard to find it, but it's on page 2, the deletion of lines 12 and 13. While that doesn't specifically say 80-20, that's what that language means.
So could you interpret that for us, please?
Well, with the language in there, then it basically says that it's two loans made by the same lender, and generally those are 80-20, 80% first, 20% second.
Am I missing something?
No, it doesn't. Those words are not there, but that's what the words are conveying.
Representative Tomei, if I may, it essentially what it means is that that the first and second is owed to the same beneficiary, and so they would. So that what happens is that either the first or second is oftentimes sold to different people.
I know that.
In today's market, and so
I just don't understand how
that was a loophole that we're trying to eliminate in this.
And case. You have to read it all in context of whole sub two, you know, section one sub two, because that's where it also talks about. Created at the same time.
Okay.
Representative Riley.
I had the same question. I want to clarify and make sure that what Mr. Martinez is saying is it was made by the same lender, and what I understand is it really says is owed to the same lender, and those are two different things.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, absolutely correct. But that's our understanding. That's the language we were looking for, and we're certainly willing to go back to our council and legislative council to make sure that that accomplishes that.
Okay.
Well, I appreciate your testimony, Mr. Martinez. I'm sure we'll have another conversation about this bill going forward, and I, you know, also wanted to make sure that we have a chance to let others weigh in on this as well, and I appreciate your work on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Was there anybody else signed up for that one?
No, that was the only person.
Okay.
Yes, and on a related note, that's the one.
The last bill, or I'm going to close a public hearing on LC 136 and open a public hearing on legislative concept 198.
Nobody signed up.
Just a moment. Committee, don't have anybody opposed or for this bill on the sign up sheet.
Well, by all means, that's passive.
And so I just did want to briefly let you know about this bill. This bill has come forward from some complaints that have come from consumers who have found themselves getting their insurance benefits denied and sometimes their policies canceled because of a pre-existing condition that was unrelated to their claim to start with. And upon looking into the statutes, we found that it's pretty broad and a lot of ability to eliminate policies and benefits due to unrelated pre-existing conditions. And so this bill is meant to essentially eliminate some of those instances where people lose their benefits for cancer treatment because there was a previous history of hypertension, for example. There was a certain case where that happened. And so this bill is aimed at doing that and basically eliminates the ability to rescind the policy or the benefits based on those situations, but does allow them to rescind them if there was a fraudulent misstatement or something like that in a nutshell. So that's it. We'll see what comes forward with that. I hope that I'm able to have some more conversations about that concept as we go forward with stakeholders. And seeing nobody else in the queue, I'm going to close the public hearing on legislative concept 198.
Good.
And is that's last on the agenda.
10 out of 10, Mr. Chair.
Again, if anybody wishes to provide testimony on any of these legislative concepts that we heard today, we're going to keep the public hearing. If you can send written testimony in for another week, because a lot of folks haven't had a chance to really look at a lot of these issues, and one of them. To avail them a chance to weigh in before February gets here on these issues. So with that, I am going to close the Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability.